All right, this is Larry Johnson, and we have the other Larry here, J. Lawrence Cunningham, a dear old friend, and we're old in both senses of the word. So, I mean, we've known each other for 30 years, and we're also in the gray hair phase of life. But
It's okay. Wisdom.
Brother Cunningham is an experienced Secret Service professional, but he's not just your run of the mill. So, Larry, welcome, and go ahead, give the folks a rundown on your background so they know that you're just not some skinny guy sitting in a Barca lounger offering opinions.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, Larry Cunningham here. Larry Johnson and I go way back. We have been involved in a number of consultancies, both domestic and international. But in terms of my background, we're staring at 50 years, actually. Hate to admit it, but time flies. 50 years, 20 years in the Secret Service. And then since that time, I retired in 1994. Since 94, I have been doing a number of security consultancies basically across the planet. Most of them actually address issues and security measures and failings that we saw in the Butler PA assassination attempt of former President Trump. It's noted that I was involved in probably 30 or more security advances, mostly leads for President Reagan during my tenure at the Presidential Protective Division in Washington, D.C., before I was reassigned to the field. That was 1982 to 1987. Certainly in the field, I did similar security advances for the Pope, Gorbachev, Clinton, Herbert Walker Bush, and a number of other heads of state during my tenure there, in addition to doing investigations, evaluating intelligence, and making determinations on threat levels and commensurate vulnerabilities for each of those respective dignitaries. There were several other in the interim, but those are the notable ones. In addition, I've been involved with a variety of security consultancies where I've assessed risk for a variety of corporations and other countries, organizations. For example, the United Arab Emirates Royal Family Security Detail and Measures and resources in the UK. They have a number of properties there. I spent about 2 months evaluating and making recommendations based on the surveys. In addition, I've worked with the in Saudi Arabia evaluating their security, particularly their officer corps. And I train them with other agents and other government resources to bring them up to snuff. I've also had in the private sector, just to name a few, I've evaluated and restructured the security detail for Oprah Winfrey and Michael Jordan and other notable folks, to include Harvard University, GW University, NASCAR, and a variety of other organizations. I've had smaller ones as well. And notably, I can tell you that the security measures are similar. Maybe the number and the quantity may be different, but the basic elements are the same, whether we're talking about a foreign dignitary from an obscure country in Africa or the President of the United States, or a small protective detail driving Oprah Winfrey from her apartment to her studio. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So that's my background. I've also done additionally recently a lot of premises liability cases, which specifically speak to evolving threats, vulnerabilities, and issues that have occurred with the respective clients. And my basic mission there, depending on the client, was to evaluate risks and or failings and to determine how they were addressed, whether or not there were vulnerabilities, and how to address the basically the I would call it basically the lawsuit or other elements that needed to be addressed. So that's pretty much the sum and substance. I've been active now for the balance of 30 years up to this moment. Notably, I've taught probably no less than 8,000 NYPD officers, their counterterrorism unit over the years, in addition to many other organizations, public
Let's
safety organizations in the United States.
So let's specifically touch on, you weren't just doing the lead on these. You also helped set up both training curriculum and physical standards that should have been met, that my understanding is they've disposed of those standards. Could you speak to that for just a bit?
It's interesting. I was going to get to that, but that is very, very important here, has direct bearing. Yes. The background there is in 1982, I was asked and tasked to develop a comprehensive physical fitness program for the Secret Service. At that time, I was assigned to our training division. As you recall, President Reagan was shot in 1981. There was a lot of concern about our post-shooting trauma program, our physical fitness, our ability to respond to these things, not only proactively, but reactively. And it was found that we didn't have a unifying, comprehensive, state-of-the-art fitness program to include medical screening. And what that meant was we didn't have consistent training throughout. It was kind of ad hoc, candidly. So with the congressional inquiry on the assassination, it was deemed that the agency had to formulate a strict fitness program, medical screening program, and importantly, attack on the principal exercises held at Beltsville and other venues to encourage and enhance the game, the game plan, much like a football team, soccer team, whatever, except this is deadly serious. So those are the things that I was involved in at the seminal level many years ago. Based on what I saw in Butler, Pennsylvania, and what my sources tell me, that mandatory fitness program, which required quarterly adherence, mandatory shooting programs, and other trainings have basically been bypassed and neglected, apparently due to resources and other interests. So I can tell you that was conspicuously absent and on full display in Butler last week.
I know what one standard in particular back what you put in place was a mile to get into the Secret Service. You had to run a mile and a half in 12 minutes, and
Correct.
now they've lowered the standard to 20 minutes, which I know a lot of fat old guys with some disabilities that could make a mile and a half in 20 minutes just walking.
Absolutely, and that's very concerning to me for a variety of reasons. Obviously, the mission is in jeopardy when you have folks that are allowed to do that kind of thing and approach that vital component in such a casual, offhanded manner. The other thing is it jeopardizes the folks that are doing the protection and the public. So to have sort of a laissez-faire attitude about fitness, about a sense of urgency and adaptability, is very, very concerning. The enemies, as you know, terrorists and others, do their surveillance too. They do their proactive preparation. And this is not lost on them. They see this. And so, from a variety of perspectives, this vulnerability is not just a one-off, it's multi-dynamic, multi-factored, and it's multi-factored in a negative way, in my view.
I know you commented on in the immediate aftermath of this, somebody was smart enough to bring you on and say, "Hey, Larry, tell us what you think." And you did, and you were appropriately cautious then. You weren't jumping to conclusions. You're noting that some of this looks bad, but let's get the facts. Well, now we have a lot more facts out. So let's just go through it systematically. Number one, who is responsible for doing advance work at a venue like this? Is it local police, state police, or the Secret Service?
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up. No one's mentioned this yet from all my review of all the existing analysis up to this moment today. The first thing I want to mention is that is strictly the purview of the United States Secret Service. After the assassination of Robert Kennedy, security for presidential candidates was added to the statute, Title 18, United States Code, Section 3056, parens A, parens 7. It specifically addresses presidential candidates. So that's without question. And what that means is when the agency, Secret Service, goes to a venue anywhere in the United States and even overseas, negotiations are made, but let's stick to the United States. There's no question that that entire responsibility rests on the Secret Service. No question. It's established in law. It's been tested, and there's no wiggle room in that, if you will.
Okay.
So bringing some of the information to the point right now, some of the initial responses from the director, frankly, the existing director of the Secret Service, was that those things were delegated, or, for example, the rooftop 150 yards away was the purview of the Butler County Public Safety Department, Butler PD, and/or state police combined. Simply not true. To abdicate that type of responsibility that clearly rests in the purview of the Secret Service, candidly, is nothing short of negligent and irresponsible.
Yeah.
And there are many other things that add to this irresponsibility and negligence, candidly, that is very, very disturbing that we know now.
Okay, so let's go through the others, because normally my understanding is when you do the advance work, and I don't want to give away any, necessary tactics and procedures of Secret Service, but you at least try to extend the perimeter out as far as necessary, that you can be assured that you will prevent any possibility of somebody attacking the principal.
And that's absolutely true. And I want to start with the fact that every vulnerability within physical parameter reasonability, and what I mean by that, I mean, it'd be difficult, and I'm not being facetious here, but it'd be difficult to identify all threats from Mars or the moon.
Yeah, right.
However, to say that, for example, an outer perimeter post or an outer perimeter building 150 yards away is not the purview of the Secret Service is nothing short of ludicrous and insane. I'll give you an example. A lot of people don't realize that there are many elements of the perimeter, not only in a stationary sense, but when the motorcade is moving or the protectee is moving, that perimeter is very dynamic. It's not a nice, neat 360-degree rings of protection, inner, middle, outer perimeter. It's what's above, it's what's below. And the whole premise of that is to create as much time and distance for a would-be assassin or someone intending to do harm to extend that as much as possible. We need as much time to react. The best way to do that is to do a proper advance. For example, when the motorcade arrives at a, for example, when an airplane arrives at an airport and the motorcade departs, prior to the plane landing, there are elements of surveillance in the immediate area to make sure there's nothing untoward. There's resources in the sky that do that. When the protectee lands on the ground and gets into the motorcade, that basically begins a cascade of other security elements, a very proactive level under normal circumstances. For example, there's a helicopter, and that precedes the motorcade by significant distances. There are supposedly, I mean, should be a drone that does the same thing, especially at the site. Well, that helicopter element or the pilot car, for example, in a motorcade and other proactive elements have done a lot of work the day before, the day of, hours before, 20 minutes before. And their whole purpose in life is to look and see, are there any vulnerabilities that have developed in the last 10 hours,
Yeah.
5 hours, or the last 10 minutes? The point of that is it's not restricted to 150 yards. That's the point. It can
Yeah.
be miles. And to say that we all are only responsible for areas within a perimeter that we've defined is simply wrong. Simply wrong. Secret Service is supposed to be responsible for any threat within reason, to be able, within physical reason and capacity, to be able to identify and neutralize. So that particular response is completely irresponsible and devoid of any understanding of physics and the statute.
Now, as part of the advance work, they also, once they determined, hey, we got this building, got line of sight, if some sniper was up there, the Secret Service would n necessarily place themselves or place state or local police up there with a particular mission you keep your ass up here until the event's over, and you're going to be in radio communication with us in the event you see anything. Would that
Absolutely.
so that would be the SOP for this, correct?
Yes. And I can, yes, absolutely. And I can tell you from my experience, and I've had small, medium, and large venues with as many as 80,000, for example, at the advance I did for the Pope in Carmel and Salinas, California. I've done many levels of protective arrangements and security advances of things in between. But the bottom line is, depending on the venue, depending on the geography, and depending on the threat level and the resources available, we put together a plan in an integrated, collective way, cooperating with everybody involved to determine what is the best way to maximize protection for identified vulnerabilities, clearly identifying what the roles and responsibilities are and post it accordingly. So in this case, in Butler, apparently now some reports are saying, and based on documents that I've looked at and reports that have been given to me from my sources, the Butler PD basically was not in that building where Crooks was on top, well, Crooks was positioning as his assassin's nest. Well, that's fine. But then if that vulnerability wasn't addressed or that post wasn't posted properly, it was incumbent on the Secret Service advance personnel to post maybe a state police or other personnel, or typically I would pair them up, pair an agent up with a local authority to make sure they have sort of double coverage, if you will, but clearly a very proactive post. If that wasn't available, I would make sure that that access to any building within that reasonable perimeter was accounted for and surveilled and posted. It's very simple.
So if you're in the command center and you're running the, you're the agent in charge, you're going to be able to look at the different video screens and see that that building's not covered and say, "Hey, get somebody over there on top of that building now." Correct?
Absolutely. In fact, all this though should have been identified at the onset, at the beginning, during the advance arrangements. And in this case, since it's a campaign stop and it's very fluid, that probably was occurring about 3 to 4 days ahead of time, ideally. In the old days, we might have had a little bit more time. In the current administration, in the current setup, there are fewer days. And some of the reasons, which are true, the Secret Service has been given fewer resources and they've been spread very thin. However, given that reality of fewer resources, there are ways to overcome that with the technology they have now. And there's other folks that you can do with cooperation in the contiguous counties to make sure that obvious vulnerability is covered. Mutual aid is one of the paradigms and one of the measures they incorporate to accomplish that mutual cooperation.
So the other news that's come out is that the agent in charge on this was actually not the regular agent detailed to protect Trump, that the sort of a last minute replacement, ostensibly because the Trump detail needed a break, needed a rest. And this guy comes out of the Pittsburgh office, reportedly. At least that was the last information I had. It could be incorrect, but sure sounds like not experienced and definitely not competent.
Well, you're right. And here's another twist that came out this morning. I've been following this pretty closely. And apparently, Dr. Jill Biden was in the area as well as Vice President Harris. And according to the sources that are giving us information, not only to me, but to the media, that those details siphoned away personnel that otherwise would have been assigned and were assigned to the advance for former President Trump, which further diluted the situation. So you're absolutely right. That continuity, that team was fractured and it was substituted with folks that may not have known each other, much less worked together. Let me take a pause real quickly and explain how this works. Normally, under normal circumstances, if a detail is identified, a candidate detail is identified, it's obviously temporary because the candidates only have protection for a shorter period. What happens is that folks in the field, agents, are identified to work and formulate a candidate detail, a candidate protective detail, three shifts. So they draw these people in. They have some vetting process. It depends on who's in charge, frankly, and how they vet these people. But the rationale is, I want to get the best available in the field to formulate this candidate detail. They come to Beltsville, Maryland, or other locations, and they train together. The idea behind that is to develop a team, develop instincts, get to learn one another. Let's respond as a group. The best metaphor for this is any sports team, football
yeah.
team,
yeah.
soccer team. They train endlessly to learn each other. It may be just a movement, a voice, a sigh, whatever the case. The whole focus of this is to develop a team that's seamless, comprehensive, and works like a well-oiled machine. When you start diluting that and putting in other resources to include Homeland Security folks, which they did, that's that public record, you've diluted that. That's not to say the folks that are in that on that team aren't well-intentioned, but they haven't worked together.
Right.
You couldn't bring together all these different positions and expect to win the Super Bowl any more than expect to be able to counter threats that you need to do. And that was painfully obvious when we saw the assassination attempt last Sunday.
Yeah, and you're not even sure what their qualification standards are. I mean, you can't say that just because they're from DHS, they've met a certain level of qualification, both in shooting, handling firearms, and in assessing and dealing with security situations.
Exactly. We used to conduct what's called a protective operation briefing when I was in our training division, and we went all over the country. And the whole purpose of that course was to help the local police become familiar with our terminology, the way we moved, the way we responded. And the idea was, once a detail was identified, folks would come back from these various departments and periodically go through our attack on the principal exercise and other things, which is another point I'll bring up in a minute. The whole idea, though, of this is to make sure we're on simply the same sheet of music.
Right, right.
Candidly, it's obvious they were not.
Yeah.
I've been through innumerable attack on the principal exercises in my 20 years. And then when I was in our academy, I helped refine those and implement those. And to give you an idea, there would be a building, a threat coming from a building. There might be a motorcade route. There might be a stop at a dais or an impromptu roadside, whatever. All of those scenarios and others were incorporated into the training, and threats would come out, unknown threats to the detail, and then they would be filmed and the communications would be recorded, and they would come back for a hot wash to see what they did correctly and what they did incorrectly. It's obvious to me that the folks that were responding and doing the evacuation, not the response agents in the immediate detail, but during the evacuation, that those folks had not done an attack on the principal exercise. And I do want to mention that the inner perimeter response was good. They covered the protectee quite well, and they evacuated when apparently they deemed it appropriate. I wasn't privy to that communication, but the actual guideline is what we call alert, shield, and evacuate. Is there a problem? Yeah, gun, whatever the case may be. Shield, which they did very well, and they evacuated. There are a lot of dynamics and nuances in that that are different for each attack, but that's the general response, and they did well at that. My concern, as well as everyone else's, is what in the heck is going on in the outer perimeters,
right,
counter snipers, and so forth. And that speaks to the advance, that speaks to interaction with the police, and so forth and so on. And this is where we have, candidly, a terrible disconnect.
Okay, so we've established, number one, failure to provide the properly staffed, experienced team. Failure,
yes,
number two, failure to do the proper advance and secure the perimeter. So number three failure, and then you just touched upon it, is you've got, I'm assuming, Secret Service personnel who are outside of the inner perimeter. They are interacting and moving around and observing, and they are working with state and local police to try to identify any potential threats, correct?
That is the way it's supposed to be on paper. Yes.
Okay. Okay. So that's what should have happened. Now, what we know happened is multiple people identifying this Mr. Crooks with acting suspiciously, moving around. It's not clear whether he carried the rifle in or pre-positioned the rifle, whether he carried the ladder in, pre-positioned the ladder. We do know he showed up with a golf, a range finder, which he used for calculating distance to target. And with all of that, it was communicated back to the agent in charge in the operations center. And so this brings up failure number three. Once you've
Okay.
identified a person of suspicion, why the hell did they let Trump go out on stage until they resolve that issue?
And this is the burning question, and candidly, the burning mistake, if you will. It's just incomprehensible to me and anyone that's done in advance. And let me refine what you said there a little bit, Larry. He was identified as a person of interest at 5:30. Actually, no, earlier than that, I think it was 5:03, 5:06. So it wasn't until literally 35, 40 minutes later that he was found again based on observations and so forth. To me, that's the first glaring problem. Once that's reported, that should be the responsibility of a roving team, whether it's a team that's been established with the Butler PD or state police. But primarily, that responsibility rests with the Secret Service. When an advance team is normally set up and with the normal resources, there's such a thing as called a roving team, which they implemented at the White House after the fence jumper about 10 years ago. And they've had that particular element at most advances throughout the last 40 years at least. And the purpose in life of that team is to do exactly what we're talking about. If a person of interest is identified or a suspicious activity is identified, that team, intelligence team, or roving team, whatever you want to call it, they call it an ID team in my era, their job is to go out and ask questions about this and make it a top priority to find out who this was, what was the behavior, what did he look like, whatever they could possibly find out. In police parlance, that would be considered an APB. Obviously, if a person of interest is at an area like a rally site with a high-level protectee, candidly, that should be among the highest priorities of that moment. There are others, certainly, but that's something that a team should be dispatched to address ASAP. That wasn't done because there's a void of time there, at least 30 minutes. And more, 40 minutes where this person was unknown, and then they found him again. Apparently, he was engaged, or someone noted that from a counter sniper perspective. Two officers climbed up on the air conditioning unit and peeked over the top and saw the individual. And then, yet, there was several minutes after that when they actually identified, between the time they actually identified a imminent, there's no other way to describe it, an imminent threat. There was a painful lapse of 5 and 10 minutes. How that should work, and it's been admitted by other agents that have done advances more recently than I, but it's just simply common sense. That particular notice with high urgency, top priority should be communicated to the command post. Apparently, it was, I hope, if there were interoperable communications, but for whatever reason, it wasn't acted on. That is among the highest priorities that you would be given in a command post. The command post is set up with Secret Service representatives and the local public safety authorities in there. And they would hear it all together. It's not just one channel, it's multi-channels in there, interoperable communication. That would have been the highest priority. And to your point, Larry, that is when they should have halted everything and kept the president, presidential candidate, or other protectee in a holding area. Proper advances have those areas, places to hide, areas to hold in case there's a problem, a secure area, whether it's the limo or whatever. You're absolutely right. With that kind of information, the protectee should have been sheltered in a safe area until that was neutralized, identified, or cancel the event until we can identify was if this is a lone person, are they acting in concert with others? And that brings to mind lots of other things. So these are some of the terrible missteps that we had. Other things that, to your point, that we're missing here was the helicopter, which I described, drones, IR sensing equipment, and candidly, intelligence roving teams. And worse, they actually reduced the number of agents and siphoned them to other areas. Now, hold that thought, those things I just mentioned, those pieces. Now we have credible intelligence, credible reports that there was a threat from Iran to take out former President Trump. That's been ongoing, but apparently a human source a human source from our folks overseas transmitted that to the FBI and the Secret Service. The point is here, they knew that there was an ongoing assassination threat to former President Trump. Worse, though, they knew that it was more recent, and it was more recent intel saying that that threat was still alive and still viable. This is well before the rally in Butler. So we have a situation where we know over time Iran has been very public about their desire to take out former President Trump. How in the world, with that intelligence, would you allow these elements that are normally given to most advances and most protective venues not be included? Worse, how in the world could you justify siphoning agents from that to another venue, another protectee that didn't have that same type of assassination threat from a enemy state? This is the part that drives me nuts and makes me very, very concerned. So in the face of this kind of threat, you have allowed yourself, or you weren't given, and I don't blame the advanced agents entirely. I know they're at the mercy of the folks that give out the resources, but whomever's making the decision at the higher level, how could you possibly justify siphoning agents to somewhere else when you have a viable threat that's been reinforced and doubled down on from an enemy state?
Yeah.
Worse than the next piece, knowing that, how in the world could you allow that protectee out of the secure area and onto the dais exposed until you could neutralize that threat? So these are the things I know right now.
Yeah.
And there's others.
And I'll let you know, I'm skeptical of the Iran threat information coming out just because of the tradition of CIA and FBI to lie in these situations to try to turn the heat off elsewhere. But the point is, let's say it was Iran, or it was any of the adversaries we've identified, that it was ISIS, whoever. The point is, if you follow proper security procedures, it don't matter. They're not going to be sitting up on the roof taking a 150-yard shot.
Absolutely.
You know, that's it. Now, let me ask you about identify friend or foe. I don't know what the practice was in your day, but like, you know, what police do when they have color of the day, so you know who's authentic, who isn't. We've seen it both in the Russian army and the Ukrainian army. The Ukrainians wear a blue band around their arm, and the Russians wear a white band. I understand that one of the issues that was out there for the counter-sniper teams were they were not sure initially if this guy was part of local police, state police, or if he was actually presenting a threat. And because they didn't have any way to identify, is he friend or foe?
And you're absolutely right. And this I've seen in a number of different reports and from my sources. I can tell you that that kind of disconnect would require stop everything. Let's identify who this person is. I mean, clearly a police officer or a member of whether it's Butler County counter sniper or Secret Service counter sniper or a police officer or state police officer or even a security guard, auxiliary police, they would have identifiable uniform. And also they would have communications. So if there was a question about who is on that roof, you simply call up and find out. And it should be actually in very well detailed in the preliminary security survey, and then also the actual advanced survey. There's a very well documented paper trail, which we're going to see. And candidly, that could be verified very quickly. And if there was a disconnect or a question at all, once again, you keep that protectee sheltered until you can resolve these things. So my concern overall is there's a lack of sense of urgency here. It seemed like it was, I don't want to say lackadaisical per se. I'm sure these folks wanted to find out, and whether or not it was resources or whether or not they were overwhelmed, and did they have the proper training to instill this sense of urgency? In general, I don't see the same sense of urgency and serious as a heart attack attitude, if you will,
yeah,
in the normal crop. And this has been shared by a number of my colleagues from the old era. I'll mention another thing that has me very concerned. My tenure on the detail was 82 to 87. And you know what the technology was like in those
right,
days.
Right.
We did not have phones. We did not have real esoteric IR beams and sensing military.
We had stone tablets and chisels, you know.
Pretty much. But what we did have, we had common sense and we had instinct.
Right.
And we had a commitment to make it work. And I mean, you work till 4 a.m., you work till 4 a.m. And I can name 20 people I know that we did advance it with that did just that, no questions. Oh, crap, we got to go out there. Yeah, let's do it. So that's the type of thing that if you're shorthanded and you're unsure and you there's a lot of questions, you make it happen as best you can. I remember my boss at the time was as committed as they get. And admittedly, among all of us, we knew that we could cover about 70% based on available equipment, intel, and diligence.
Yeah.
There's always an element, 30%, 25%, that you simply cannot account for. You take a protectee into a public area, you're exposed, as simple as that. A venue like a rally, it's even more concerning and more difficult. So the point is, if you go by the numbers of the existing documents, couple that with your instincts, couple that with your best diligence, and you put all that together, you might get 70%. But what happens when you miss something? That's the magic. If you're working hard and you've done all the other things properly, you will have developed a go-to list, a go-to behavior, a go-to protective behavior that can kind of adapt as you go. Is it perfect?
Yeah,
absolutely
yeah,
not.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing that, heck, a football team does, soccer team. I mean, things happen on the field that you don't always anticipate. But if you've done your good training and you've developed a good rapport among your core agents, you're able to adapt to that and mitigate that pretty successfully.
Yeah.
So these are the kinds of things that have me very concerned. It's not just the one, two, three, we're looking at these documents, which are extreme failings, but there's another element there that I don't see happening. And candidly, I think it's a critical element. If you're going to put a team together that's as serious as a heart attack, life and death, you better have trained ad nauseum. And if you can't cut it, I'm sorry, George, you can't cut it here. We're going to bring somebody else in. You want that team to be as committed, as dedicated as possible. And I get fired up about it because this is solvable and it was preventable.
Yeah, it was just like when I went through get certified as a training counselor, which means certified as somebody who can train pistol instructors. The qualification was you had to put a six inch grouping at 15 yards with a minimum of 16 to 20 shots inside that 6 inch grouping. If you can't do that, you didn't qualify. It was very black and white. It didn't matter if you got 15. It didn't matter if you got 14. You either got the minimum of 16 or you didn't qualify, because you're going to be in a position of teaching people to be instructors. And if you can't do it yourself, what the hell basis do you have instructing anybody?
You know, that's definitive criteria. And you're speaking to something that has me concerned once again. Jason Chaffetz has been online. A lot of folks have been talking about this. He in particular was involved with the inquisition of Secret Service culture, methods, resources, behavior, and performance. And that was brought up after two things. After the penetration of the South Grounds with the jumper, jumped over the fence, ran up to the South Grounds entrance, went in through a door that should have been locked. It's all documented, all public record. The officer there let that person in. Okay, now we have an outside threat that's traveled what, 100 yards at least, up to the inner sanctum, inner perimeter. They're inside. They have a weapon of sorts, clearly not authorized or screened. And an off-duty agent was able to recognize this as being a problem and neutralize that person, arrested that person and tackled, et cetera. So two things, the counter snipers were on the roof at that time, or were they? They're assigned there. I don't know that they were vigilant on those on that area, but they have 2000s-esque technology. We had 80s technology. And there's a bleep, a warning that tells people when that perimeter has been penetrated. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened to that. But based on all that and other issues that have occurred, behavior issues as well as response issues, Jason Chaffetz and also Lieberman did a full expose on everything they found. And candidly, it ran the gamut. And if you have a minute, I'll just explain why it's so important.
Yeah, go ahead.
Number one, the culture didn't always trust the hierarchy because the hierarchy couldn't do exactly what you're talking about. They couldn't walk the talk. They were expanded to beyond belief in terms of resources, did not have enough resources. The other thing is, during that period, a lot of senior folks retired. Just the timing and the chronology at that moment, those folks were retired early. Not early, they just retired. But those mass retirements created lots of voids for agents that were not otherwise prepared to fill those positions that they were filled. So we had a void in leadership because those folks were prematurely placed in leadership positions they weren't necessarily prepared for or had the background and
right,
experience.
Right.
That was another factor. Then they had resource issues, which contributed to this. Like my French teacher would say, c'est pas d'excuse. There's no excuse. It's a reason, but it's not an excuse.
Right.
If
right.
That kind of thing was noted and there were other opportunities to address it and it wasn't addressed, that's on the leadership.
Right. Right.
And that was a real problem. And that's exactly, frankly, what we're seeing repeat itself here 10 years later.
Well, so let's go to the SOP for counter snipers. So there initially, it looked like there was only one counter sniper team. They're the ones, as you're looking at President Trump, they are to the left of the audience up on a roof, or to Trump's immediate right behind him.
Actually, there were two teams.
Yeah, but there were. But I'm saying the one that people saw were the guy with the tripod up and then the guy laying prone, which then led to that stupid comments by the Secret Service director about the slope of the roof, which has led to just an explosion of memes making fun of the Secret Service. Such things as you can Fed proof your house by installing a ramp. You know, that way the Secret Service can't get up at the, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway,
it's tragic comment. Tragic comment.
So it was assumed that they were the ones, but then it never comes out. Their vision was occluded by a tree. A tree obscured their line of vision, so they did not. They were not actually able to see the shooter, even though they were looking for it, trying to find him. Second, when the shooting started, they hunkered down, or they started taking cover instead of returning fire, which is what you're supposed to do. But as you correctly noted, it turns out there was another counter sniper team to Trump's left, and as the audience looked at Trump, to the audience right, up on a roof, and they did have the clear line of sight, and they're the ones that took the shot that killed Crooks. Question is, did they have to wait for instructions to be able to take the shot, or did they have permission to take the shot if they believe there's a threat?
Okay, that is something that's, in my experience now, it's been many years, 40 plus years since I've been on the detail, but that hasn't changed. They have the purview. It's well established in the docs, in the standards operating procedures, that the counter sniper team have the purview, the unique purview, to autonomously take out a well-defined threat. Again, no excuse. They don't have to go to the upper manager to do that. That is a purview that they have. It's in the documents. It's in the SOPs. It's been approved. And that's been true for at least 40 years that I know, and probably longer. And otherwise, they wouldn't be viable.
Yeah.
If you have to go up the ladder and say, well, and some, let's just say, that's a tough decision. And you can imagine if a supervisor is or a public relations agent, or is thinking about there's going to be some hesitancy. There's going to be some dulling the response. The response isn't going to be immediate. So that purview is very strictly defined, and they're allowed to take out. They're obligated and mandated to take out a threat like we saw last Saturday without running up the flagpole, and that's well established. And apparently, there's some questions about whether or not that was done, whether or not they ran it up through the flagpole. Again, we get back to the point that the command post knew this. Someone in the command post had this information. We're going to find out they couldn't make a decision. It was too, they're not used to it. There's concern about it, whatever the case may be. And so that's why you had that delay from the three shots and then the additional five. And let me go back just a little bit. The director in charge during that period of time when that fence jumper made it all the way up to the inside the White House, that director at the hearing praised the agents for using restraint. Now, I don't know if that was a personal thing or if that's in the culture now. It appears to be, but we're not talking about restraint if someone wants to kill people. Particularly, someone wants to kill someone that you're mandated and trained, and that's all you do. That's your Bible. That's your first response to take out a well-defined threat. When someone jumps the fence and runs up to the White House, you need to take it out. I mean, you're going to get fallout and everything else, but to wait is unacceptable. So to call that restraint is really an oxymoron when you're describing the responsibilities of a counter sniper.
But your job in the Secret Service, it's real simple. You, to protect the protectee so that they are not harmed. And if you don't protect properly and they're harmed, you fail. This was a failure. There's no other way to look at this, as it was
Absolutely.
no, no participation ribbon.
It's a failure. Now, where does the blame go exactly? I'm giving a little bit of a pass here. Certainly, Inner Perimeter, I thought, did a pretty decent job. Let's even take the attack and the principal training out of it, whatever. But we're talking about leadership, the message that's being sent down, whether it's direct or subconscious or subliminal. The bottom line is you don't get that sense of urgency. Also, they haven't been given the opportunity to train. So now we have two big problems when you come to responses. There's a little bit of a hesitation. You can't have hesitation in a direct threat like this, and you need training. So if those things are lacking and you're not given the support you need, whether it's moral support or mandated support and resources, you're going to get hesitation. You're going to get a problem. We saw last Saturday.
Now, what about the orientation of the second counter sniper team? Because you would, you know, and maybe I'm incorrect in assuming that those teams should be, I guess, oriented in opposite directions. But in this case, that second sniper team was also oriented in the same direction where the shooter was, because there's no way for them to hear gunshots, turn around, get on a scope, and hit and shoot crooks. Because I've seen some reports claiming that the shooting went on for 26 seconds, which is complete bullshit.
I know,
And
it's
it's
unbelievable.
six
Well,
seconds. It was a 6 second total amount of gunfire.
I'm familiar with the counter snipers in my era, and even more recently, the last maybe 10 years, I've supplemented some advances, for example, the World War II Memorial dedication, some other things. I can tell you that normally they do a very comprehensive, thorough survey. And the whole idea is to look at the site, look at the dais, whatever, wherever the protectee is going to be. And then their job in life is to look around to any vantage point that would offer a good shot or someone to cause harm from a other location, whether it's a tree, a berm, a hill, another building. And based on that and their experience, they position themselves accordingly. I haven't seen enough documentation to see if that second position was in the right place. Based on the maps that I've looked at and the schematics, I question it. But I question more as to why you didn't, if you didn't have the manpower, why didn't you do something about that particular location?
Right,
Now,
right.
apparently the Butler County Commissioner, and this is unverified now, it also came from him and also reports from another commentator, actually Dan Bongino, who has experience with this and also has connections. Apparently there was a Butler County counter sniper team that either didn't show or wasn't assigned, or also may have been positioned somewhere else we don't know about, that may in fact have taken that shot. We don't know yet. But the if these kinds of questions are out there, again, it speaks to a very ship-shod,
yeah,
weak advance. This should be dialed in like clockwork. There should be absolutely no question, especially when you consider such a critical element of security in an open environment like a rally.
Now, I want to debunk one of the conspiracy theories that's out there. There are a lot of people now saying, oh, there were two shooters, or some of you say three shooters. And I come back, they say, if there were two shooters, or let's say even three, number one, how were they communicating with each other to coordinate shooting? Because once, if Crooks is shooting, we don't hear any shots before Crooks starts shooting. And once Crooks is dead, we don't hear any more shots after he's dead.
Exactly.
So if you've got a second shooter or a third shooter, what's to prevent them from continuing to drill into the back of the heads of some of those Secret Service agents? If their job was really to kill Trump, and you had organized at that level with multiple shooters, they would have kept lighting up the stage until they got him. That didn't happen.
I think you're absolutely right. But again, another concern I have is we haven't heard too much, and we may never, about the existing intel. We did hear about the Iranian threat, and maybe that's nebulous, whatever.
Yeah.
Regardless, we know that a lot of folks, based on the daily threat level just by itself, directed at Trump, it's high level.
Yeah.
It's high level. It's disproportionate to Dr. Jill, it's disproportionate to Harrison, frankly, disproportionate to Biden. He has the most threats of any of our protectees on a daily basis. And that fact alone should indicate that he should be given commensurate resources. And he was not, very simply. That's a fact. He was not given resources commensurate with the threat, to counter the threat level.
Okay, so let's wrap up with this by coming down to the, you know, your fundamental judgment. Are we dealing with pure incompetence, or are we dealing with something that's far darker and more disturbing? Because, and I'll just simply point out, there's also the timing of this attack. 2 days before the Republican National Convention, had Trump not turned his head a quarter to a half inch to the right, he'd be dead, and the Republican National Convention would have just been a major food fight. It's not even clear they could have come up with a candidate. What do you think?
Okay. I'm relying on my instincts, 50 years in the business, still learning, always able to learn more. The privilege of having been at a training level, policy making level in the field as a street agent, and then also as a journeyman agent on the protective detail, and then a supervisor, and then supervising advances and being an advisor for agents that were going to be assigned to do advances. So I've seen it from the ground up. I think it's multifactored. Based on my initial view of this, my first concern is the leadership and the training. The second concern is this particular director was appointed by the Biden administration, by Joe Biden specifically. There are reports out there on that. Based on responses and based on information I'm seeing and how it was set up, I sense there could be some bias there. The fact they would siphon agents away has me very concerned. To your point about something more sinister, we don't know yet, but I would not take it off the table. When I initially did this a video and my commentary last Sunday, I was a little bit more circumspect. I was looking at the facts. And I still am looking at the facts, but the facts are more and more damning, and they also open up more and more questions. The concern I have is that the FBI, frankly, is involved with this process. And with all due respect, they've proven themselves to be unreliable and in many cases, partisan.
Yeah.
Just simply true. I'm sorry.
I agree. I fully agree, brother. Fully agree.
I get no credit. I get no satisfaction saying this. I knew some from the old days and worked very well with them. I'm talking about this new era and worse, this diabolical leadership that we have. It has nothing to do with that. You can't be partisan when you're supposed to be objective. Now, getting to my point, yesterday at the convention, Mike Waltz, a seasoned military member of Congress now, is saying, and he's on a, I think, Armed Services Committee. He has a lot of good instincts and various things. He's saying some of the information he's getting, and again, I don't know that he's verified it entirely, but apparently Crooks had two phones, and one of the phones are having difficulty getting into, and he said yesterday, it hadn't been picked up too much, but he said basically that from what they've determined now, what the information is getting back from some of the forensics, is that Crooks' phone had three encrypted accounts from three foreign encrypted accounts. Now, I don't want to create a conspiracy thing. Well, Iran
that report's out there now. It's not just
but
so.
That is extremely concerning.
Yeah.
So with all these other obvious, blatant security lapses, and you have this kind of information coming in, I'm very concerned. So I can't definitively say, and I don't think anyone else can either, that it's simply an operational thing or simply a training thing or simply a resource and management thing. I think there's other factors. So it's more damning than it was Sunday.
Yeah.
That's probably
yeah.
And there are more questions that have arisen that have been answered. So I think we need to keep our eyes and ears open. But I feel saddened by this. I mean, this is our great country, and to have this bipartisan stuff go on and have these unknown questions about someone who was on the radar and they didn't respond to them. I mean, this is security 101. Regardless of the theories, when there is a fact that someone is identified as a threat and they have identified then later with a weapon, and that particular normal go-to protective response is not done, I'm shocked. I'm aghast.
Yeah.
I know these folks do the best they can, but I want to know why.
Yeah. And, you know, I know you've been getting phone calls from people, both former and current, that are expressing their concerns. And, you know, you and I know a bunch of people, you know, like Doug Laird and Glenn Wynn and, you know, some of the old timers. You know, there's a standard. And, you know, that standard was completely missed. And in this kind of activity, you're not allowed to have misses. You know, I mean, this is one where you have to be perfect.
And I think, sadly, I think it's a multifactored problem. I mean, we're going to find out there's more percentages in one piece than the other, but it's a multifactored mess. I mean, there are so many opportunities to fix this, to adapt or cancel it, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, so anyhow.
Hey, brother, listen, I appreciate you taking time for this. I will, as this develops, I'm going to call upon you again and bring you back on. But you spent an hour helping, you know, because a lot of the commentary that's out there, apart from Dan Bongino, because Bongino, he was on the job, you know, he knows, but he never, I don't think he ever served in the training division, and he, you know, he was a good agent.
I don't
in the
think
field.
He did. I mean, in 7 years, I can't imagine he did as many advances as some of my other colleagues and me, for example.
So he, but it's not to diminish his experience at
no,
all.
He's
but
got good experience.
It's important to get people like you who've been there, done it, got the T-shirt, and can talk about this in an intelligent and, you know, restrained manner without going all hysterical and all, conspiracy theory.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'll leave you a little philosophy too, and I use it all the time. But Emerson would say, you know, what you are speaks so loudly, I can't hear what you're saying. Well, I'm great. I'm great. I got it covered. Well, what you are is obvious. Show us what you did. Actions speak louder.
Yeah. Yeah. And the actions in this are sort of devastating. It could have really pushed this country into a terrible cycle of violence. Thank God it didn't. And I'm thankful that Donald Trump, at least in his remarks last night, instead of calling for revenge, was calling for forgiveness. So thank you, brother.